uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live coast to coast on radio stations from Oregon to West Virginia, or from California to North Carolina, whatever. Beaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite system, streaming around the planet, WhiteRoseSociety.org, RadioPower.org, American FM. Welcome back to our program. It is so nice to be here with you. It's the 23rd of February, Wednesday, 613 days since treason was committed in the White House by a person still unknown, although Bob Novak, who participated in it, is still showing up every day at CNN. Go figure. Well, a lot to talk about the news today. Did you see Canada? Paul Martin, the Prime Minister of Canada, has just slapped George Bush in the face, metaphorically. This was just announced by CBC News a few hours ago. This is big news in Canada. It may not be big news in the United States, but I can tell you at the White House, they're going to take it kind of shaky. Because 2 months ago, George W. Bush went up to Canada and leaned on Paul Martin and said, you know, we got to get this Star Wars thing going. You know, we got these defense contractors and they're big donors to the Republican Party. I mean, they give millions to the Republican Party and we got to be sure to give them billions. Well, actually, under Reagan, we gave them over $1 trillion and I want to give them all this. But see, it won't work. We can't protect North America if Canada doesn't participate, because Canada's part of North America, and how can you, I mean, you know, any kind of incoming missile is going to go over Canada before it gets to us. And so Martin said, all right, we'll go along with that. Well, Martin lost his majority last spring. See, they have this thing in Canada called democracy. They actually have proportional representation there. And so his government lost its majority in the Bloc Québécois, which I'm probably mispronouncing. French is not one of my languages. And the New Democrats, which we would call liberals here in the United States, oppose the plan. While the Conservatives support it but want a full debate on Canada's role, this in Canada. As well, Martin faces stiff resistance in his own caucus. The Liberals also want to improve their fortunes in Quebec, where there seems to be little support for missile defense. So, here comes this story from the CBC. Prime Minister Paul Martin will reject Canadian participation in the U.S. Missile Defense Program. That's the lead sentence, CBC News, Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. Martin plans to announce in the House of Commons as early as Thursday, that would be tomorrow, that the country will not partake fully in the controversial program. So it looks like tomorrow, astrologically, it must be. You know, it's like you look at the stars, and it must be a bad day for George, because he's going to be meeting with Vlad the Impaler, who is not happy at the moment. Mr. Putin saying, basically, hey, quit kicking me around, buddy. We got some problems here. We got some real problems here in Russia. I won't say he's trying to privatize their retirement programs, but he's made all these changes in the pension programs and whatnot that have just got people flipped out. He's got internal protests. He's got terrorists in Chechnya. He's got, you know, all the old communists. So for the folks who said, you know, hey, we may have a lot of millionaires and billionaires now that we didn't have before, but we've also got a lot of poverty now that we didn't have before. And there's a startling rumbling within the country about let's roll back some of this free market stuff. And, of course, the reason why is because this transition to free market democracy that happened in the former Soviet Union happened, number one, very quickly, and number two, happened largely on neoconservative terms rather than traditional social democracy terms. In other words, they did it more like the United States and less like Sweden. Or more like the United States and less like France and Germany. They didn't take the time to build a strong infrastructure of labor, strong opposition parties. They didn't, you know, organized labor is pathetic in Russia. Basically, they just said, oh, gee, free market. Let's have some billionaires. Let's have some millionaires. Wouldn't that be cool? Let's sell off all these government businesses, because the government owned everything before. You know, let's sell off something. It all fell apart. So anyhow, tomorrow George is going to have to face Vlad, and he's also probably going to hear from Paul Martin. It's going to be an interesting day, an interesting news day. Got an interesting email here from Liam. I'm probably mispronouncing. In Switzerland. Just wanted to thank him for that. It's about the op-ed piece that I have on Common Dreams today. You go to commondreams.org. I haven't yet updated, put it at the top of our list. In fact, I was going to do that this morning. I'll have to do that when I get off the air. On TomHartman.com, the article's on democracy. You just go right to commondreams.org. And it's called When Democracy Failed, and it's about the parallels between the failure of democracy in Germany in the 30s and the failure of democracy in the United States since 2001. And Liam writes, I like the originality of your writing and hope to find more of your books as soon as you reduce the problem of your books soon as you reduce the problem to a nutshell and really show the essence of the problem. And he's talking about Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, which he also liked. He says, greetings from an Irish guy from snowy, freezing Switzerland. By the way, I often thought that the Swiss direct democracy would be an example to follow for those wishing to try real democracy. Here, the elected members are more like administrators, but the power remains with the people for every decision. Here we get to vote every second weekend, practically of every single issue the government can decide nothing. It does give a lot of social cohesion, though. We've had referendums on getting rid of the army. He said it's so go as the yeses are increasing. Reducing the working week, rejected, alas. Reducing taxes, to be rejected. Join this or that organization or international agreement, etc., etc. There are referendums at the state, cantonal, and local level, including whether to have a new kindergarten in the neighborhood, etc. Take care, Liam. Thank you for sharing that with us. It's the insight into, you know, other countries actually work. What a remarkable thing. What a remarkable thing. Two big things in the news today that I want to talk about briefly. I'll just introduce them. We've got a couple of callers. I'm going to pick up a couple of calls here and say hi, see what's on people's minds. Our number, by the way, 1-866-889-8894. The website, if you'd like to drop into our chat room, which is already boogieing along, full of folks, subliminal mixed messages. Now, that's an interesting handle I haven't seen before. Anyhow, welcome to our chat room. You go to TomHartman.com and click live chat. It'll get you there. The two stories that I think are really jumped out at me are, number one, this thing about the bird flu. The World Health Organization now has flipped out. The CDC chief made a very outspoken, very concerned, very worried statement yesterday, had to back away from it a little bit, but in backing away, she almost backed back into it. That being one story, broadly, one big news thing. And the other is the collapse of the dollar, this just sudden burp that happened. And we'll get into those in just a minute. But let's first just, you know, find out what's up that would cause John in Pennsylvania to call so early in the program. Hey, John, what's up?
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up, John?
All right. Well, two things. Both of them involve how conservatives, when you try to perceive what the most effective and most probable counterattack would be from conservatives. A few weeks ago, Bernie
counterattack
Sanders was,
to what?
Excuse me?
Counterattack to what?
Well, these two issues. The first one was Bernie Sanders' proposal that he said was trying to work through Congress to make fair trade measures with China when he was on lunch with Bernie.
Right. His proposal was to end most favored nation status.
Yes.
You know, which
now,
which is
what
big,
would be the most to me, the most probable conservative counterattack to that would be, oh, what if we, you know, anger China? What if they stop buying our debt? Do you think that that's a real problem?
It's a huge problem. I mean, what happened yesterday was that the Korean controller of the Treasury, in a footnote, you know, one sentence footnote to a document, said that the Korean government was considering not holding as high a percentage of their foreign reserves in dollars And, I mean, this wasn't a statement by the government. They haven't done anything. In fact, they've come out now today and said, no, no, we didn't mean it. Don't, you know, just calm down, everybody. But just that little footnote. And the Dow drops 130 some odd points. The dollar, you know, oil shoots up. The dollar drops against the euro to a point that it hasn't seen in 4 months. And we've seen 4 months of gains just wiped out overnight. That's how skittery people are, because Korea has the fourth largest foreign reserves collection in the world. In other words, they're sitting on a pile of cash because they've been exporting for years and years. We're sitting on a pile of debt because we've been borrowing like crazy since Reagan.
So Bernie Sanders' proposal, as benevolent and as good as I think it is, you think has real consequences that we have to worry about in foreign policy and financial matters?
Absolutely. It can't, in my opinion, it can't be done without also taking into consideration the fact that China right now could bring us to our knees economically.
Yeah, that's what I was afraid of.
Yeah.
The other one is Andy Stern. Are you familiar with him?
And well, before we get to that, by the way, let me just point out, also, Bernie, at the same time that he is suggesting that we end most favored nation status with China, is also suggesting that we start balancing our budget and get our economic house in order. It's one of the reasons that he goes in there and regularly kicks Alan Greenspan around, you know.
Yeah.
So
the other one is Andy Stern, leader of the SCIU. Familiar with him?
I've heard his name.
Yes. He was on Unfiltered today. Very, very good guest. You should bring him on. He has really a lot of good ideas about labor.
Yeah.
One of the things he talked about, this is just one idea, was union dues being used to balance wages in China, get a level playing field. I mean, he had a lot of ideas. But in general, he did point out this one, that the airline industry is the most heavily unionized industry in the U.S., and they are also one of the ones with the most financial problems. And that, to me, struck me again as the most effective conservative spin. Oh, unions won't work. Look what happened to the airline industry. They're crippled by unions. Meanwhile, Walmart flourishes without unions. And how do we answer that? And those are my two questions, and I'll let you take care of that from now.
Sure.
Thank you.
Okay. Thanks a lot, John. Well, I think the first question we've talked about, and we'll get back into. The second one, the airline industry's problems have nothing to do with unionization. I mean, they have to do with changes in the marketplace, the increasing price of oil, and in my opinion, insane pricing policies. I mean, there are a lot of flights that I have not taken because I couldn't book it within that 14-day window. And the fact of the matter is that you've got airlines that are doing very well, thank you very much, and paying their people very decently. I'm not sure if they're unionized or not. The discounters, I suspect they're not. But I really don't think that that's the variable. In fact, I'm quite sure it's not. But what we have seen ever since Reagan is this attack on unionized industries. And George W. Bush is proclaiming last year that he's going to take 800,000 government jobs and outsource them. Why? They're trying to diminish the power of the government employees union, some of the largest unions in the country. Same thing with the attacks on the teachers union by Rod Page, you know, calling them terrorists of all things. So, you know, but the reality is that, well, yeah, okay, you can say Walmart's very prosperous without unions, but do you want to have a world, do you want to have an America where you don't have a middle class, where everybody's working at Walmart wages? The conservatives apparently do. 20 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you.
Attention, Tom Hartman.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
You can get it if you really want.
Yeah, but you got to join a union.
Really want.
Or get together with other workers and say, you know, we're going to stand up and say, this is what's right. If you just want to know the answer to a question I have discovered, just ask in the chat room. Go to TomHartman.com and click live chat and ask in the chat. I typed in here during the break, is Southwest unionized? Bang! Back comes the quotes. William Driscoll, president and directing chairman. I represent you. It goes on and on. Anyhow, here's the... It's interesting. The if you go to Southwest Airlines website, there's a page on there that points out that Southwest Airline, they talk about, you know, Southwest being a low-cost carrier, and they say, you know, many people think this means we're not unionized. They say, however, Southwest is the most heavily unionized of all the airlines. 81% of their employees are union members, and it is the most profitable of all the airlines. So, Chew on that, Bimbo, Rush Bimbo, and others on the. Yeah, that's so. There's your answer with regard to the airline industry. As far as ideas for unionizing folks in China, I just have to say this is, yeah, it would be a marvelous thing. And I know that there are some unions that are trying to that are moving international. The government of China, however, says there's only one union, and it's owned and run by the government. Thank you very much. End of discussion. And besides that, raising the wages of people in China is not, in my opinion, what should be the main foreign policy and trade policy goal of the government of the United States. It should be raising the standard of living and the wages of the middle class in America, of the working class, of working people in America. And it was until Ronald Reagan became president. And then we started this whole conservative economics, voodoo economics, trickle-down economics, supply-side economics insanity. For 25 years it's been going on. And what do we have? It's like one of those, you know, my parents went to Cancun and all I got was this lousy T-shirt thing. I mean, it's a, you know, our country went to the right wing and all we got was this lousy loss of the middle class. We got this lousy minimum wage now is a joke. And on it goes. So in answer to your question, John, yeah, general wildness. Let me just, before this next break here, and I'll take a few more calls after the break. I know we've got a few people on hold here, but this is important stuff. I want to get this out. The World Health Organization, and we've got a break coming up in 2 minutes. So the World Health Organization urges governments to draft contingency plans. Now, the question in my mind is, why is it that that George W. is running around the world freaking out about Iran and Iraq? Two countries that, by the way, had nothing to do with 9/11, as if 9/11 is like a huge deal. I mean, 3,000 people died. Yes, that's a terrible thing. But we're talking here with the bird flu about maybe a few hundred million people dying. Why is he not discussing this? Why is he not calling for the... This is from the Associated Press. A top international health official urged the world's governments on Wednesday to start drafting emergency plans for a possible pandemic stemming from bird flu, warning that a deadly outbreak was perilously close. We at WHO, the World Health Organization, believe that the world is now in the gravest possible danger of a pandemic. Says this top international health official with WHO. If the virus becomes highly contagious among humans, the health impact in terms of death and sickness will be enormous and certainly much greater than SARS. He says this is why we are urging all governments to work now on a pandemic preparedness plan so that even in an emergency such as this, they will be able to provide basic public services such as transport, sanitation, and power. I remember my mother telling me stories of she was not alive during the flu epidemic of the 1918-1919. But her father was, and stories about how people in the community told her stories about her, how her father was one of the people who went around and took food to people who were sick with that epidemic. And, you know, just it was a time that changed the lives of everyone. And it may be coming again, and it could be a really, really, a real crunch. We need to be doing something about this. Hey, George, wake up! 29 minutes past the hour.
Information, visit laborradio.org.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
In the midst of this, here we have the Centers for Disease Control chief, Julie Gerberding. Gerberding? I wonder if you can flip that name around to throw a bird in there. Anyway, Julie, the head of the CDC, on Monday during an association, the American Association for the Advancement of Science. This is the AAAS. They published the journal Science. This is the top of the pile here, science-wise. Dr. Gerberding compared the signs of the current growing avian flu threat with the buildup before a worldwide flu epidemic in 1918, which is believed to have killed more than 20 million people. Now, keep in mind that the population of the planet right now is 6 billion people. In 1960, the year Jack Kennedy was inaugurated, as he was saying, ask not what you can do for your country, or not what you, whatever, you know, ask not what your country will do for you, ask rather what you can do. As he was saying that, at that point in time, there were only 3 billion people on the planet. As of 1930, there were only 2 billion people on the planet. So there were fewer than 2 billion people on the planet. It was like 1.7 billion or something in 1918. So we had a population that was less than a third of what it is right now. And it still whacked 20 million people. Our population density much greater. And in the midst of this, Bush's budget comes out and he says, you know, in order to pay for these tax cuts for the rich, we've got to cut back on health and human services. Let's cut $970 million out of this program. Yeah, that's wise. That's real smart. I get that. All right, he wants to cut $4 billion out of education. Hey, we can't compete with the Chinese. What are we going to do? Let's cut $4 billion out of education. Yeah, it's only 2 weeks in, or 2 days, 4 days. It's 4 days in Iraq. But still, we can't afford these 48 programs. Arizona Senator John Kyle, it ought to be expanded, not eliminated. This is from today's Associated Press article by Alan Fram. This is a Republican. He's talking about aid to states with imprisoned criminal aliens, $300 million program Bush wants to eliminate. Pennsylvania Republican Representative John Peterson, we'll fight it with everything that's in us. Talking about Bush's plan to end vocational education subsidies. It's $1.2 billion out of the education budget. Mike DeWine, Ohio Republican senator, a senator from Ohio. It does a lot of good. It reaches a lot of young people. About a $2 million program Bush wants to erase. This one supporting teaching about the Underground Railroad for escaping slaves. Kyle Peterson and DeWine are all Republicans. Strange stuff going on. Dangerous epidemics. Vladimir Putin. The folks in our chat room pointing out to me that Putin, Russia has a lot of economic activity, you know, deals with Iran. In fact, they have been supplying Iran with their nuclear reactor stuff. People say, well, Iran is sitting on all this oil. Why do they want to have nuclear power? Something I just learned this last week, which I didn't know before. Iran has passed the Hubbard Peak, and they know it. It's public knowledge. More than half of their oil has already been pumped. That means it's getting real expensive to pump oil in Iran. And Iran is seeing the 20-year horizon on the window on the horizon. 20, 30 years, they're going to be out of oil. Just like Pennsylvania is, just like New York State is, just like New Jersey is, just like Ohio is, just like Michigan is. All these states used to be huge oil-producing states in the late 1800s, early 1900s. I'm sorry, late 1900s, early, yeah, late 1800s, early 1900s. Mix up centuries. The late 19th century, the early 20th century, they were all oil-producing states. They're not anymore. They pumped all the oil up. And so Iran is saying, hey, we only have a certain amount of oil. It's limited. Let's do what the French are doing. It's almost 100% nuclear power in France. Let's go to nuclear power. Now, I personally think that's dumb. They're in a part of the world where they could do very well with solar power, but, you know, that's their choice. Bush is not pleased, though. He's going nuts on this. Anthony in Maryland on the line. Hey, Anthony, what's on your mind today?
Well, good afternoon, Tom. Just want to tell you it's refreshing. Your show is so refreshing and inspiring, and thank God that you're on the airwaves.
Well, thank you, Anthony.
Well, I just wanted to say you made me laugh, and the reason why I called is I have a friend who's into astrology, and you were saying something astrological must be going on. Well, it just so happens tomorrow is a full moon, so it will be interesting to see what the outcome will be of President Bush and Putin.
Oh, my God. He's on a full moon. He's meeting a man named Vlad.
So, but my friend, unfortunately, who's very much into this, indicated to me that there are not good things in store. Unfortunately, you know, economically, that's why I thought of her yesterday when the Korean thing happened. I called her. I said, this is really bad. She goes, yeah, there's more coming. I said, all the chickens are going to come home to roost. This is unsustainable the path that we're on, the policies that we maintain, and the economics that we're playing. So we're in for rough sailing, unfortunately.
It doesn't require a rocket scientist to figure this out. I mean,
I know.
I'm not accusing you of stating the obvious, Anthony, but the fact of the matter is the Republicans haven't figured it out. And all across America, there are people listening to right-wing talk radio who haven't figured it out. Gee, you know, we have a 25% increase in the last year in our external foreign trade deficit. I mean, if your tax bill went up 25%, or if you're, or if somebody cut your paycheck by 20%, you'd notice it. Say, hey, what's going on?
Yeah, no, at some point, the people are going to wake up, and I think the Republican Party is dooming itself to being a minority party probably forever once the reality of the consequences of what we've been engaging on sink in and everybody gets it. Because there will be a day when everybody gets it. Hopefully it's sooner than too later.
If the media allows it to get through and if we don't slide into fascism, those are two huge ifs right now. Back in 1929, the last time the Republican Party tried this kind of economics, which was through the 20-year period that led up to 1929, or 30-year period, let's say, the last time the Republican Party did this exact same thing, and Woodrow Wilson wasn't all that great, by the way, and the Democrat in the middle of it all there with World War I. The last time they tried this same thing, it led to the Great Depression, and we had a relatively free press. Most of the press was locally owned. And now we've got the major television networks in particular owned by multinational corporations, one of which is a major defense contractor. And I'm just very concerned. I mean, this is a situation that's far more analogous to Italy in the 1920s than it is to the United States in the 1920s. And the chicken's coming home to. I'm just concerned that they're going to start blaming. You know, oh, it's you know, as Hitler was. Oh, it's the communists, and then oh, it was the Jews, and oh, it was the the trade unionists, and oh, it was the and blah de blah de blah. And the blaming. I mean, right now they're trying to do the small blaming. Oh, it's the gays, right? But when the economic stuff comes, they're going to be going after the unions. They already are. They have been. They're going to be going and on and on. It's going to be the blame game, and they've got the microphone to do it far more than we do so far.
But if the problem doesn't get solved, and people are, when the social crisis reaches a point, they can't ignore it, and eventually that will come home, I believe that will come home to roost. One last thing, and then I'm going to let you go because I know you have other callers. Another piece of economic news, which is bad for our country and really just irrational. Yesterday, the Bush administration pronounced a change in policy. You know, it is legal to sell food and medicine to Cuba. And Cuba is our neighbor right off the coast of Florida there. And certainly there are, I hope and pray that things will change there. But the way that we are trying to go about it, there was a law that passed that allowed sales of food and medicine. And very successful. In fact, Cuba has become like in the top 25 purchasers of food products in certain categories. And the Bush administration effectively changed the policy to make it impossible now or unlikely that Cuba will continue to buy food from us. And that's going to affect a lot of people in farm states.
Yeah.
So I hope you look into the Cuba issue as you do your show.
Will do. In fact, thanks, Anthony, for the call. In fact, yesterday I was speaking with a friend of mine, was it yesterday, day before yesterday, who just came back from Cuba, of all things. And I have to tell you, I have very mixed feelings about what's going on in Cuba, because I would not want to live in a country where I couldn't criticize the government. On the other hand, they've got great social programs. On the other hand, you can't criticize the government. And so, frankly, I'd rather be here than there. But what Bush is doing is, in my opinion, is he's just pandering primarily to the right-wing Cubans that down in Miami and whatnot, and ain't a good thing. Alfred in Wyoming, Michigan, on the line. Hey, Alfred, what's on your mind?
Oh, great. I want to quote. I'm sure you've heard of John Steele Gordon, a historian. He wrote a book back in '97 called Hamilton's Blessings, which got a good review from the Wall Street Journal.
Yeah, he's one of this new breed of conservative historians.
Well, this is what he said in the book on page 121. Very enlightening about 1932 when the United States, because securities, he stated as a sovereign power, are the safest possible investment in bad times. And the Treasury was able to borrow at a very low interest rate in 32. But
right.
He pointed out that indeed, so great was the fear of total financial collapse among the nation's remaining rich in 1932 that the interest rate on Treasury bills, the federal securities with the shorter maturity,
right.
actually went negative in the fall of 32. In other words, people were actually paying for their privilege of investing their money with the government in order to save it from a revolution.
Right. Well, I would suggest that that's really the reverse of what you're suggesting he was saying, that people were afraid of the government collapsing. In fact, that it indicated, I mean, there was a whole bunch of stuff going on in there. I don't recall which year it was that Roosevelt made it illegal to hold gold, but I mean, there was just so much.
33 when banks were closed.
Yeah,
Michigan had the,
yeah,
the first one to close the banks before Roosevelt.
Yeah, yeah. And so, there was just so much going on back then. And frankly, what I see right now, because we didn't go into the Great Depression with huge, enormous external debt like we have right now.
No.
Excuse me. And the analogy, the situation that we are facing right now economically is much closer to what Germany was experiencing in the 20s. In part as a result of the Treaty of Versailles, after World War I, they were hit with all these huge penalties. They had to pay reparations. And in order to get in order to bail themselves out of it, they just started printing money like crazy, which is essentially is what Bush is doing right now. And he's borrowing like crazy, but, you know, it's the effect long term down the road is not all that different. And I think we're facing a hyperinflation more than we are facing a deflation, although either one is possible. I mean,
Well, he pointed out in 1930, I think taxes were like $4 billion, and in 32 and 33, they only collected $2
billion. Yeah.
And outlays in 1930 were $3.3 billion, and $4.7 billion in 1932. And if my memory serves me right, I think 1947, Truman's whole military budget came to $41 billion.
Yeah, I don't have the numbers, but we've been through a lot is the bottom line here, Alfred, and I appreciate your call. Thank you very much. We've been through a lot here in the United States. We will make it through this, but we must wake people up to what's going on. I mean, this is just nuts. Chris in Hartford, Connecticut on the line. Hey, Chris, welcome to the program.
Tom, thanks very much. I'm a first-time listener. I love your show. Very impressed the conversations of how fair you've been about different topics. One of the things you brought up with regards to Iran and the nuclear facilities there and so forth, and the fact, hey, listen, the oil eventually is going to run out, and these guys are being proactive. And instead of, like, nudging these guys into a confrontation every single time that Bush talks, he's trying to nudge these guys into confrontation, put them against the wall.
Yeah, he's playing bully. It's the only game he knows how to play. He's been playing bully ever since he was a kid. A friend of mine's husband went to school with him at Yale, and they got in trouble when they were in the fraternity, and they got busted. They went down into a minority neighborhood and busted up some stuff, and I think a car got set on fire or something. And George walks into court late, with no socks and casual clothes, and just walks up to the judge and says, "How much do I have to write this check for? I'm in a hurry."
Right.
I mean, this is like, it's like this is his life story. He was born on third base, thought he hit a triple. As Ann Richards said about his father, and he's a bully.
Definitely. And, Tom, when I was little in the 70s, I lived in Iran for a while when the Shah was there. And back then it was an issue. They were talking about, we're going to run out of oil.
Well, that's because they were overproducing. The Shah was overproducing like crazy. I mean, in order to help us out. I mean, that was one of the reasons why we kicked out, what was it, Mossadegh that we kicked out and replaced with the Shah?
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I appreciate your time. I just want to tell you, a fantastic show. Very impressed.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Chris. I do appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Keith in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina on the line. Hey, Keith, what's on your mind today?
Hey, how are you doing?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up, Keith?
Just a question for a poor old citizen. Our government always, we're looking for money. We've got this. The deficits are crazy. How does a citizen find out where all this ridiculous pork that gets tagged on to every law that's passed, the pet peeves of each congressman?
Right. The cotton museum in Louisiana kind of thing you're talking about.
Oh, it's endless.
Yeah.
Where does a citizen go to find these things that you can actually look and see what they have done and where they have wasted our money?
Well, the senator from Wisconsin, the late senator from Wisconsin, whose name is escaping me at the moment, Feingold, I think, was his name. used to have his annual Golden Fleece Award, in which he was a Democrat, in which he would point out who was the biggest pork spender. John McCain has been maintaining that tradition to some extent. But the reality is that I'm an absolute opponent of stupid spending, federal spending, but the reality is that the real pork, the real incredibly wasteful spending is mostly going on in the Pentagon. I mean, here we have just in Iraq alone, just in that one country, just in this one event, $8 to $9 billion that the Pentagon can't account for. In the previous 30 years, we have $1 trillion that the Pentagon can't account for, and nobody's holding them to account. Everybody's scared to death of them. That is a major problem. You know, and people say, well, we got a $3 million cotton museum down here. And I mean, those are things that need to be pointed out. I would say contact your congressman and just say, you know, I'm not in favor of this kind of stuff. But thanks for the call. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you, Keith.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Tom Hartman here with you. The Tom Hartman Program. We're tuning in as it is as easy as getting a White House press pass if you're a gay hooker. Yes, indeed. Just find us on Sirius Satellite Radio. You can find us on the web. You can find us on your local radio station. Happen to be in your market. Welcome back to the program, 1-866-889-8894. The chat room, it's amazing how we're all coming up with extended electronic brains. I'm starting to feel like I'm in the Matrix. The chat room corrected. Thank you. Bless you. Thank you all. Bill Proxmire, Feingold is still alive. You know, here I killed off a senator, and you know, Bill Proxmire was the senator who did the Golden Fleece Award, and bless him, he was doing a great job. But you want the real pork? $150 billion a year in corporate welfare. Compare that to about $40 billion a year in human welfare. See that the pointing to the small, relatively small chunks of pork, and they in the grand scheme of things, frankly, they are relatively small in the budget, is a great way to divert our attention from the fact that there is this enormous corporate welfare program, and the limousine conservatives are just making out like bandits. While they're saying, ah, look at this. It's a, you know, pointing here, there, and the other place. JR in Portland, Oregon on the line. Hey, JR, what's up?
Hello, Mr. Hartman. I've got a question about Iran. I've been noticing in the news that they had a 6.5 on the Richter scale over there.
Yeah, they've had a couple of them this week.
And my question is everybody was talking about what a missed opportunity the Indonesian situation was as far as relief, you know, how we could have shown that we aren't just a warmongering country and that we do help.
Right. An opportunity to reach out. Yeah, we did this with Iran with, you know, when the big earthquake hit them in Bam, Iran, what was it, 2-3 years ago? Problem is that most of the aid that George Bush promised never showed up.
Yeah, you know, and right now all George Bush can basically say is, oh, well, we're not going to attack you, but all things are on the table.
Yeah.
You know, I just don't see how, as a foreign policy, you can't take opportunities like this to heart and say, you know, this is the way that we can get to the people. I think the biggest mistake is lumping government and the people into the same barrel because people are subject to the government. Government usually isn't subject to the people.
Yeah, well, what we have in the case of George W. Bush, J.R., is simplistic thinking at its worst. It's at its very, very worst. And it's a foreign policy that is, frankly, suicidal. And you know, just, boy, God help us. We need a lot of help to get through this thing, through this 4 more years of this. It's scary. But we will pull through. We always have. This country has seen worse, believe it or not. And we will have better times in the future. We just have to keep on plugging. Keep on plugging. Keep getting active. I'm Tom Hartman.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from Vermont to California, streaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite radio system, beaming across the planet on multiple, shall we say, multiple web channels, radiopower.org, whiterosesociety.org, American FM. The Star of the Beast program is starting to bear fruit. And it's going to be very interesting to follow this and just see if the American people buy this thing, hook, line, and sinker, the way that it has been just laid out. 3 years ago, 4 years ago, it must have been about 3 years ago, because I was talking about it on the radio. The Wall Street Journal had a column where they interviewed a bunch of conservatives, and they say, you know, what's the deal with all these tax cuts and deficit spending, which doesn't seem like a conservative thing. You know, conservatives historically have been deficit hawks. Conservatives have historically said, we don't want to have budget deficits. We don't want to have a nation in debt. Why would we want to do this? And the response that came back from, you know, Grover Norquist and his bunch, or that general ilk, was, it's the starve the beast strategy. You put through the tax cuts for the rich, and it cuts back the revenue to the federal government to the point where if you got rid of all the social programs, you'd have a balanced budget. So no more social welfare, no more spending for education, no more spending for Social Security, no more spending for Medicare and Medicaid. Get rid of all those programs and have the government simply keep the army and the prisons and the police, and even start encouraging local communities to have their own fire departments. Let's shrink government. This is their philosophy. And you have to, you know, acknowledge the fact that at least they're consistent about it. It's just that they're not honest about how to get there. You see, this is supposed to be a democracy where if the majority of us decide, you know, yeah, okay, it's a good idea to get rid of Social Security. If the majority of us agree, hey, yeah, let's do away with that. So only wealthy people can have retirement programs or can have any kind of insurance. And if a kid loses his parents and becomes an orphan, or if somebody breaks their back and is paralyzed and they're not rich, screw them. Tough. Let them be like in India, where they sit out on the street corners and beg. I remember one of the first times I was in India, it must have been 1980, 81. I was there with a good friend of mine, Tom Larson, in fact, and we were there to talk with a local Indian fellow who was a wealthy businessman who wanted to deed some land to this international relief organization that I'd done work with to create a community for you know, orphans and whatever. And I remember waking up. We were staying in a nice hotel right down by the waterfront in Bombay. And I remember waking up really early, jet lag, you know, just as the sun was coming up, 4:30, 5 o'clock in the morning, 5:30, whatever it was. And going over and looking out the window down at the street, it is just starting to, you know, the activity is just starting to stir. And this truck comes along, this flatbed truck. And in the back of this truck, there was 20 or 30 kids. And this guy pulls up to the corner out in front of the hotel and throws out. There's a guy in the back of the truck, and he grabs a blanket from a pile of blankets and tosses it on the street corner, and then grabs one of the kids and hauls him off the truck. And I see that this kid has missing one of his legs, and his other leg has been, you know, is deformed, and sets him on this blanket, puts a begging bowl in front of him, hops back up on the flatbed truck, and they head down about two blocks and drop another kid off. It's like putting out the vending machines in the morning. And so I went, you know, later in the day, I asked the concierge at the hotel, I said, well, you know, what's the deal with this truck that goes around dropping off these kids? And he said, that's the local mafia. He said, they buy these children, and then they cut their legs off, or they'll break their legs so that they maim them. So that they're more pathetic, so that people will give money. And so they're less likely to run away. And then when they've got them sufficiently docile, they put them on the street corners and they come around, you know, in the middle of the day and take them off so they can use the bathroom and feed them and bring them back. And they put in a 10-hour day. I mean, this is, if that's the kind of country we want to have, if we want to have a nation where we have no social safety net, we should have a debate about that in the United States. We should all discuss it. But the conservatives are not doing this in an open and honest fashion. They're not saying, let's go to the American people and say, do you want to have a Department of Education? Do you want to have Head Start programs? I mean, let's just have a vote. We're not talking about depriving minorities of their rights. So this is something that you can just subject to actual, real, raw democracy. You know, the marvel of a republic is that it protects the rights of minorities, and a democratic republic, which is what we have, is that the will of the majority is enforced in the context of protecting the rights of the minorities. Well, you know, if we're going to have Head Start or not, for example, where you invest $200-$400 in a child before they make it to kindergarten, and you just so dramatically reduce the probability of them ending up in prison or dropping out of school in later life that society makes back $5, $10, $15, $20, in some cases $50,000, depending on the studies you look at, which states they're in added revenue from productive taxpayers. Do we want to have this kind of investment in our youth or not? And if the majority of us say, we don't want to do it, we're willing to pay the $50,000 to imprison them rather than pay the $300 right now to put them in Head Start. If the majority of us say that because putting them in Head Start is a socialist program and we're not up for that. If the majority of us say that, fine. It's a democracy. I would go along with that. I would argue against it. But, you know, that's the way it is. But that's not the way the cons are doing it. The way the cons are doing it is the star of the beast. Run the government so badly into debt by giving huge tax breaks to the rich and borrowing from our grandchildren to do it that everybody agrees this is a potential disaster. We're having to borrow so much money from China and Japan and Korea that if they even blink, our currency could crash. And so we got to do something. We got to do something. We have a crisis. What do we have to do? Privatize Social Security. Get rid of that Social Security program. Put it in the hands of Wall Street. Next, it'll be privatizing Medicare. And in the meantime, let's cut 48 programs out of the Education Department, $4.263 billion. Let's kill 14 programs in Health and Human Services, cut $970 million out of that. Let's cut $1.5 billion out of justice programs, social justice. The poor really don't need people defending them in court, right? Let's cut $306 million out of agriculture programs. Let's cut $117 million out of our national parks. After all, it's socialism, these parks. Teddy Roosevelt, yeah, he was a Republican, but still, he had these wild ideas. He had this notion about a minimum wage, or living wage, actually, was Teddy Roosevelt called. And it's just going to be real interesting to see how many people in America figure out what a con job has been done. When Bush submits these kinds of budgets, targeted for elimination include $9 million for traumatic brain injuries. Oh, if you're not a millionaire and your child has, you know, falls off his bicycle or is hit by a car and has severe traumatic, tough luck. $136 million in subsidies for advanced technology research. Oh, we would like to be at the top of the pile. We would like to be the best country in the world in terms of high technology, but it's socialism to pay for it. So we'll just let China be that. $90 million in state recreation grants. Well, you know, sounds nice, that kids should have swimming pools and communities rather than, you know, running around in gangs shooting each other with guns or with drugs. But swimming, come on, it's socialism. You're giving money to the poor. It's income redistribution. You can't have that. Besides that, we can't afford it because, look it, we're broke. Well, it turns out that the Republicans themselves now are starting to push back on this. George Bush, in his speech, State of the Union speech this month, he says, "The principle here is clear. Taxpayer dollars must be spent wisely or not at all." It's just, here's the question, what does wisely mean? Many members of Congress, including plenty of the president's fellow Republicans, according to the Associated Press today, think what's unwise are his proposed cuts. And we're not talking about pork barrel spending here. I would submit to you that there's really not much of that left in these budgets beyond the Pentagon budget. 1-866-889-8894 is our telephone number. Scott in Kalamazoo, Michigan on the line. Hey, Scott, what's up?
Hey, how's it going?
I'm great. What's up?
Well, hey, I was glad you were just talking about the Social Security, the real crises, you know, the real things the budget are doing. Because I was actually going to solicit a little advice and help from you. I'm going to take action and call or email my congressman about kind of changing the battlefield and not letting the top Republicans set the battle. You know, and encourage them to disengage from the Social Security battle on the grounds that it's not a crisis. I mean, it
right.
is a problem that's coming, but it's not a crisis yet.
Right.
Where we have crises now that are laying siege to what America is and to what real Americans, regardless of party affiliation, want.
Right. I agree with you, Scott. We have about a minute left. How can I help you?
You know, well, is that right? I mean, should we be doing that and making them, you know, point out all these crises that are going on now and make them defend his putting the Social Security problem that's on the horizon?
Yeah, absolutely. Here's what
right
you're going
to
have to do, though. You're not going to get your actual congressman on the phone. You're going to get a staff person on the phone. So you need to reduce the point that you're going to make down to a sentence that can be copied down. And you just boil it down to a sentence. Hey, I don't see a crisis in Social Security. I see a problem. You know, I just say, I don't see a crisis in Social Security, but I do see a crisis if we keep cutting funding to our education programs, if we keep cutting funding to our health and social welfare programs, and if we don't do something about this bird flu that's coming. That's a real crisis. And here's the phone number for Congress, by the way. Call them, don't email them. The phone number is area code 202-224-3121. And that'll reach any member of Congress in the United States.
And then should I just make multiple calls and just each call have
yep.
one separate point?
That's right. That's right. Well,
great.
you can probably make a couple of points. I mean, you're getting another human being on the other end of the line when you get a congressional staffer. And usually their staffs are fairly small. They'll have a few people there who are answering the phone. So
are they actually going to take it serious and write it down?
They actually will. Yeah, they actually will, even when you disagree. So
great.
I encourage you.
Appreciate it.
Yep. Good luck, Scott. Thanks for the call. 20 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Cool, cool, glad you made it. Welcome to the world of entertainment. It's unlike any other game around.
And welcome back to your light at the end of the tunnel of talk radio.
Welcome to the world of entertainment.
I'm Tom Hartman, and very pleased to have you with us here. The rest of the world is looking at Georgia's Starve the Beast policy, too. See, this is brinksmanship. This is high stakes poker. Throw the country into bankruptcy so that you can accomplish your political objectives without ever there being a debate about them, because you will convince people that there is such a terrible crisis that we just have to cut these programs. We have to eliminate them. And in the process, I mean, Reagan started this. Reagan started this. Hit the wrong pot there. The wrong volume control. Reagan started this thing, and George W. Bush has been carrying this banner. Bill Clinton kind of reversed it for a short while there. The this whole process of starve the beast, of cut government revenues, cut taxes, especially for the wealthiest among us, so that there's no more government revenue, so that the government can then say, hey, we don't have any money. We can't afford to have Social Security. We can't afford it. It's going to go broke. We can't afford to have education. And then you toss in stuff like unfunded mandates. If your school doesn't have these kinds of scores on these tests, which you have to buy from our billionaire buddies, if your school doesn't have these kind of scores on these kind of tests, then you are going to be considered an underperforming school, and your kids will have the choice of going to any other school they want to. You're going to lose your students. You're going to lose the money for the students. And what does that do? It opens up an opportunity, a window of opportunity for private corporations offering school services. And on it goes. I mean, it's just it is becoming so transparent. Ellen Ratner's with us with the Talk Radio News Service, our daily report from Washington, D.C. Hey, Ellen, what's up?
Well, I tell you, it's interesting. The Supreme Court came up with a decision today, and the decision has to do with segregating prisoners in the California prison system. It was a 5-3 decision, and it ruled that state prisons cannot segregate prisoners by skin color unless there's a compelling reason to do so. And the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals allowed California prisons to do that to reduce what they called gang-related violence. But they said that the Ninth Circuit must really scrutinize the California policy to find hard evidence that it's both necessary and effective.
That's interesting. That's interesting. You can really see both sides of that argument.
Oh, you certainly can. I mean, and it's interesting because it is segregation.
Yeah.
Also, as you know, Daniel Yergin, he's the guy that wrote that book on oil from Cambridge Energy Research Associates. He was at the press club this morning, and he said that the investors and general public aren't really getting a sense and true picture of that oil company's issue. He said that when oil companies disclose their assets, they're also supposed to report a dollar figure on the size of the reserves. But somehow they are now underestimating what kind of reserves they have outside of the United States. And they said that basically people are just not saying what would really allow the United States and other countries to get more oil out so that we're not being built by which countries we have to go into next. I mean, he didn't say this, to get our oil. But he's saying that we're just not getting an accurate picture.
Yeah. Well, back in the 80s, I think it was 87, all of a sudden Saudi Arabia's reserves jumped by about 20%. That was the year by coincidence that they started going to the IMF and saying, we'd like to borrow some money, or to the World Bank and saying, we'd like to borrow some money based on our oil reserves. So there's also a lot of suspicion out there that a lot of countries are overstating their reserves in order to be able to borrow against them. So
exactly. It's interesting. That's what you're going to say. We're not getting an accurate picture.
Yeah, yeah. Fascinating stuff. Ellen, thanks for the report. Great to hear from you.
You're welcome.
And keep up the great work with the Talk Radio News Service. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 29 minutes past the hour. Defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception.
And now for a traffic update.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Welcome back to the radio home of democracy. I'm Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894 if you'd like to call in toll free from anywhere in the United States. If you're outside the United States, 1-802-229-2288. And Alice in Humboldt County, California, listening on KGOE, I would assume. Alice, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Alice.
I'm becoming a pest, I fear, and oh. You were wanting to know about our Humboldt County Peace March on March the 19th.
That's right, and you were going to call me with a phone number that we could
And who to get a hold of if people wanted to make a donation and get involved.
Okay.
I finally got the numbers.
Great.
Jack at 707-668-4095. Dennis at 707-923-3292.
Okay. Great.
Okay.
And hopefully they will be getting good calls from useful folks and not too many pestering.
It should be more than a march this year.
Yeah, it sounds
we're all very mad with this corrupt White House and we're going to let them know that.
Well, thank you, Alice. Good
good
on you. Keep up the good work.
Okay.
Thank
Goodbye.
You for calling. Good to hear from you. And also in Humboldt County, we have Francis. Hey, Francis.
Hello, Tom.
It's Humboldt County Day, I guess.
Yes, apparently. You know, Ellen Ratner really shed light for me a few minutes ago. The ignorance will flourish, and hatred, violence will flourish where peoples are kept separated. Texas prisons and county jails do not have the same racism problems. They have not kept people segregated on the basis of race. And ever since I've been back in California, I've scratched my head at why does California have all this racism amongst prisoners?
Well, it would just spiral. It seems that if you start out by saying, okay, if the blacks and Latinos are killing each other, or the Latinos and the Caucasians are killing each other, or whatever, you know, they're organizing themselves into racially organized gangs. And therefore, we're going to put the Latinos over here and the blacks here and the, you know, blah, blah, blah. Then what you're, you know, at the beginning, it seems like, well, okay, we're going to separate these guys so they don't kill each other in their cells and things. But on the other hand, what you're doing is you're establishing communities that are racially segregated.
Breeding it, just like in the 50s. There
were
all this these misconceptions, black and white, about what the other side did.
That's right, and then it becomes even more my side, your side.
To find out they were erroneous until they started working together in the workplace growing up.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it sounds like a pretty reasonable Supreme Court decision today.
Yes,
something. So yeah, it's you're apparently you're using a speakerphone and it's got some feedback.
In Texas, they have prison house gangs. Ones that got started in Texas, they have La M.A. for the Mexican Mafia, they have the Texas Syndicate. There's other gangs I don't know the names of. They've been going on all this time, and yet they don't have the same level of violence. So that's why I say that the segregation of the races has preceded the violence and the
I suspect Francis, and thank you very much for the call. It's good to hear from you. I suspect that it's more of a dog chasing his tail kind of thing, where the situation, you know, started out however it started out, and because I don't think they started out saying, okay, we're going to put this race here and this race here in the prisons. But they started out saying, it looks like we've got a problem here with these people attacking those folks over there, so we're going to separate them, and poof, pretty soon you've got a segregated prison system, and that just feeds, as you so correctly pointed out, feeds the problem. Oh my, oh my, oh my, oh my. Japan and China, I want to wrap this thing up with the economic, the dollar sell-off, because I think this is such a big story. It's in today's Wall Street Journal, of course, a front page story about it, because this is, for anybody who understands what's going on, the fact that essentially a footnote in a Korean government publication could cause the dollar to, as the Wall Street Journal notes in this article by Craig Carman, he says that the dollar's losses were so steep yesterday that the euro was able to reclaim in one trading day about 40% of the ground it had given up to the dollar over the first 7 weeks of this year. And the sell-off, some note, was sparked by just one paragraph in the document the Bank of Korea sends to its government. It wasn't at all clear that its remarks represent a wholesale change of thinking. Indeed, Bank Governor Park Si-young recently suggested the opposite. He says, although the central bank is monitoring the effect of the trend of the weakening dollar and its effect on the international financial market quite carefully. It has no plans to change the dollar portion of the reserve significantly at this time. But just footnoting it, essentially, was enough to cause the whole country to basically, or the whole world to basically just go, whoa. And why? Well, because Bush has been doing the Star of the Beast program, and it goes all the way back to Reagan. When Ronald Reagan came into office, this nation had never seen a $1 trillion deficit, or debt, rather. We had never seen a $1 trillion debt, and here we are, pushing $7 trillion in debt. The Wall Street Journal notes, although foreign central banks have been relatively steady in recent years with more than 60% of their foreign reserves in dollars, many economists believe that diversification by these banks into the euro or other currencies is inevitable over time. Well, it certainly is going to be inevitable if the dollar keeps falling. I mean, who wants to buy something that loses value? And this is what's happened. I mean, it's not, oil has not gone from $20 a, oil was at $18 a barrel when George W. Bush was elected. It's now $51 a barrel. And it's not that oil has gone up in price, it's that the dollar has gone down in value. Gold has gone from 200 and something up to $350, more or less. It's not that gold has gone up in price, it's that the dollar has gone down in value. Now, the cons, you know, trying to find the silver lining here, and actually, this is what John Snow, the Treasury Secretary, has been saying. And it's insane, but it's a falling dollar isn't necessarily bad for U.S. stocks, the notes the Wall Street Journal article. Since a weaker currency makes U.S. exports more globally competitive and boosts foreign subsidiary earnings. Now, there's 2 points there. And this is really important stuff. If the dollar becomes less valuable, that means that everybody else's currency in the world is more valuable. That means that the stuff that we buy in our stores that is imported from overseas, which is just about everything now because we don't make anything in the United States anymore, the stuff we buy in our stores that is imported from overseas is going to become more expensive. We're going to have to pay more for it. Now, the conservatives in this administration think that's a good thing because what it'll do is it'll cause Americans to say, well, gee, that stuff from overseas is a little bit more expensive. I don't think we should buy as much of it. Maybe we should buy things made in America. And, you know, they would be right if things happened in just nice, neat little boxes and vacuums. If you were to simply say, okay, we're going to take the value of the dollar and we're going to cut it to a quarter of what it is right now. Then all of a sudden, everything coming from China would cost four times as much. And there would be a lot of businesses in the United States that could start up making things that right now are made in China that could be made competitively here, perhaps. But it would take that drastic a cut. The problem is, cut the dollar, the value of the dollar by a quarter, to a quarter. You know, cut it four times, one-fourth. Then you have 400% inflation. See, inflation simply represents the decreasing value of the currency. You have 400% inflation. What happens? Those people, like the Bush family, who have their money parked in interest-bearing notes, you know, treasury notes and whatnot, which have to track the rate of inflation. Now the Treasury Department is actually selling inflation-indexed bonds. I mean, you can personally buy savings bonds that are inflation-indexed, the new Series I bonds. But the reality is that you know, Treasury bonds, all these other things, they will follow the rate of inflation. They have to. This is why Greenspan is having to crank up interest rates right now, because the value of the dollar has gone down so far. And people are saying, hey, you know, you're going to have to pay us more if you want us to hold these dollars. And so folks like that, like the Bush family, who are invested in these kind of, you know, their investments are in things that track inflation, they're going to make out just fine. But people on Social Security, people on fixed incomes, people on pensions, people who are working in the marketplace where the minimum wage is not going up as fast as the inflation rate is, that is to say the middle class, the working class of America, and the poor, the working poor of America, They're screwed. They're in huge trouble. Just as they were back in the 70s when we saw interest rates, you know, going up 20, 30%. You see, and the other problem is that interest rates go up, the value of houses goes down. It costs more per month to have the same amount of house. The value of houses goes down, the housing bubble bursts. All of a sudden, all that equity that people thought they had in their houses, they don't have anymore. And the banks start exercising that little paragraph in the mortgage agreement that says that the bank at any old time it wants, for any reason it wants, can simply demand that you pay this entire thing off within 90 days. And you start seeing bankruptcies and defaults. Because people have borrowed all the way up to the max of their credit line. Have you ever, I mean, look back over the last, those of you who have the age to remember, look back over the last 10, 15 years, 20 years. When was the last time you remember the such a preponderance of ads on TV saying, we'll loan you money against the value of your home? This is a relatively new phenomenon. Why? Because number one, there's been this housing bubble. The value of houses has been going up. The price of houses has been going up because interest rates have been so low. And number two, because the middle class is getting poorer and poorer, and in their desperation to put their kids through college and to maintain some semblance of the lifestyle that they've had, or to pay their medical bills, or to pay the increasing medical deductibles and whatnot, they have had to borrow against the equity in their homes. And so now you've got these companies, you know, Ditech and whatnot on TV saying, you know, there's that one ad, I forget which company, it's Lending Tree or one of these companies, where the guy, you know, so I've got a nice house, I've got a nice car, I've got, you know, I'm a member of the golf club, and I'm in debt up to my eyeballs. And then they say, and call us to go deeper in debt. Well, actually, the pitch is call us to get out of credit card debt and move it into your home. Move the debt into you know, being in home. And this is a disaster waiting to happen. The Bush administration has created a house of cards that is unimaginably dangerous, just so they can push through these radical right-wing economic policies that are social policies, really. The radical right-wing social policies. I hear Jack Davis, the Rochester Democrat and Chronicle, he writes an op-ed piece. He says, we just closed the ledger on 2004. America's trade deficit grew nearly 25% from the year before. The United States bought $618 billion more from the rest of the world than it sold. It's a new record. $618 billion. We're not producing the goods we consume. Now, America now even imports more food than it exports. He says, Bethlehem Republic and Lackawanna Steel built a strong middle class in western New York, as well as bridges, skyscrapers, and tanks. Now those middle class paychecks are gone, and we rely on foreign steel mills to produce armor for our troops in Iraq. China now exports twice as much advanced technology products to the United States as it imports. What's wrong with this picture, my friends? Delphi, Eastman Kodak, Corning, Bosch and Lomb, and other multinational corporations are moving R&D as well as manufacturing operations to low-wage countries. There go the good-paying jobs for U.S. scientists and engineers. Boeing is even giving away its once unchallengeable edge in the aerospace industry and all the scientific, engineering, and technological know-how that goes with it. Notes Jack Davis. Boeing, which built the Flying Fortress of World War II and led the U.S. into the jet age, has downsized and outsourced so much that it increasingly relies on Japan for its most advanced engineering and manufacturing. More of the 787, Boeing's new plane set to launch in 2008, will be built in Japan than in the United States. And we're not talking here about seat cushions. The Japanese are going to make the wings. I mean, we're talking about the fancy stuff, the heavy stuff, the expensive stuff. Every other industrialized nation, notes Davis, uses trade policy to advance its domestic industries and raise the living standards of its citizens. It's time our government does the same and abandons the failed policies. He simply calls them, I would say, the failed Reagan-Bush economic policies, and Clinton for that matter, with regard to international trade, that have abandoned American jobs, farms, and industries. A correspondent, I get a note here, the first millennium attack, the millennium being the, you know, the first year of the beginning of the new thousand years, right? 2001. The first millennium attack was 9/11. Second millennium attack, 11/9/2001, when George W. Bush torpedoed our economy with his tax cuts for the rich and borrowing and spending for everything else. EDS, now, Ross Perot's company, closing 21 call centers in the U.S., 17 out of 42 data centers, moving them to India. They're cutting $1 billion out of their spending in the United States. It's going overseas. Another billion lost to America. What happens? Their stock went up. 10 minutes before the hour.
Attention, Tom Hartman.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back.
Well, the war is over, and I'm broke and I ain't got a dime.
Well, unfortunately, the war ain't over yet. In fact, George is talking about another one, you know, in Iran. It's on the table.
Well, all my money's gone. And my friends don't know me no more.
Yes. Are we all going to be singing the blues? 1-866-889-8894. Telephone number, Diane in Grand Rapids, Michigan on the line. Hey, Diane, what's up?
Hi. I wanted to give you another way to phrase something.
Okay.
You know how the advocates of reform for inheritance tax call it a death tax?
Right.
And they use that.
It's not for reforming, it's for eliminating it.
Well, yeah. You know, whatever, yeah. Whatever words work for you.
No, I mean that's what they're suggesting is they want to eliminate the inheritance tax.
Right, right. Yeah. When they see that as a reform.
Yeah.
Well, a friend of mine suggested that we adopt similar phraseology, and we call what they plan to do a birth tax.
Yes.
Since every baby born has a tax of $25,000 that needs to be paid by someone.
Yeah, it's a good point, and well said. There's a number of people who've been saying that for some time, and in fact, perhaps you're the person who sent me some emails on it.
No, I didn't, but it was a friend of mine's nephew who came up with that, and I said, you know, I'm going to call Tom.
Oh, no, it's been floating around the Internet for a long time, and I've mentioned it on the program. The problem is figuring out where to hang it. You know, this is what the Democrats need to be doing. They need to be proactive. When Bush comes out with his budget and, you know, whatever the tax rate is, for example, and I agree, they should say, okay, there's a birth tax of $25,000 in here. There's a, you know, and they just need to start reframing all these various things that the Bush administration is doing to us and at us.
In a simple way that everyone can understand.
Yeah. Well said. Diane, thanks for the call. Great to hear from you. I do appreciate it. Oh, my, oh, my, oh, my. What can we do? Well, what you can do is you can call Congress. Area code 202-224-3121. Let your local elected representatives know what you're thinking. Write a letter to the editor of your local newspapers. Contact your local radio stations and television stations. Let them know what you think. Spread the word around. Pass it along. Tag, you're it.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
How?
man who uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. Helping you win the water cooler wars with uncommon sense from the radical middle. Tom Hartman here with you. The third hour of our program on this beautiful 23rd of February, 2005, 613 days since someone in the White House committed treason by outing Joe Wilson's wife, the CIA agent. 832 days since we began looking for weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Now we're thinking maybe they're in Iran. 1,268 days since 9/11. 913 days since the anthrax killer struck. Have you heard about that recently? You know, it helped get the Patriot Act passed. Without it, it wouldn't have happened. But, you know, it just kind of went away. One of the folks in our chat room just a few minutes ago, and it's scrolled now off the screen, so I can't tell you who it was, but one of the folks in our chat room had posted a note saying, when I call an operator, you know, like you call a help desk for help for your computer, or you've seen that Dell ad where, you know, you can get help 24 hours a day. I have called Dell's help desk, and the guy who answered had a bit of an accent, and I said, where are you? And he said, I'm in Bangalore, or someplace similar. He was in India, in any case. And so anyhow, and same thing, you know, the banks, our local phone, not the Vermont-based phone company, but the Verizon thing here. Sometimes you call for information. You get somebody outside the United States. So anyhow, there's a person in the chat room says, well, I think we ought to be able to specifically, when we call for, you know, help for an operator or for whatever, that we ought to be able to specifically say, may I speak with an American or a U.S.-based operator, please? Well, I got to tell you, the situation has gone so far beyond that, it will boggle your mind. Check out this story Jay Solomon wrote in the Wall Street Journal. I believe it was yesterday's journal. The headline, India poaches U.S. executives for tech jobs. They start out by telling the story of Doug Bettinger. Doug is a guy who says spent over a decade working at Intel, 12 years. He's 37 years old. And he was just offered a substantial pile of money to go to India. He's become the chief financial officer of Bangalore-based call center operator 24/7 customer. 24/7 customer. Mr. Bettinger is among a growing number of U.S. and Western executives, notes the Wall Street Journal, being poached, not to mention well paid, by Indian technology companies trying to globalize their software and outsourcing business. In recent months, Indian businesses have hired dozens of executives from companies including Electronic Data Systems Corp., that's EDS, Deloitte Consulting LLP, McKinsey & Company, Accenture, and Ernst & Young. Indian software giants and other Indian outsourcing companies are becoming more profitable, the journal notes. All have had annual revenue growth of around 50%. 50% a year in revenue growth. Any American company would kill for that. And they're hiring thousands of new workers each quarter. Well, they need executives to handle this. And as the Wall Street Journal notes, such growing financial clout is allowing Indian companies to woo Western executives, especially with higher salaries, quote, six or seven figures, we're talking hundreds of thousands to millions, six to seven figures are often involved and equity is also in play. In other words, you get stock options as well, says Romit Amekbagar, an Asia-based partner with Morgan Howard Worldwide, a Stanford, Connecticut executive search company. They go on to note that EDS, for example, has nearly 3,000 workers in India, expects to add 2,000 more this year. Intel says it's growing its research and development facilities in India and has been investing in Indian companies. Indian companies are now offering a degree of job security that's hard to come by in job-short Silicon Valley, notes the Wall Street Journal. Jay Solomon's byline, by the way, New Delhi. A There's never been a better time to be hiring, says Stephen Pratt, a San Francisco-based executive who left Deloitte Consulting last April to head Infosys' new global consulting arm in Fremont, California. Mr. Pratt has helped Bangalore-based Infosys recruit more than 70 executives. We're talking people who are making hundreds of thousands to millions of dollars a year. Says the recruiter, Mr. Pratt, we're hungrier than other firms. They're out there snapping up these. So now the jobs have gone overseas. And now the rich folks are going overseas. Figure this one out. What's going to be left? You, me, 7-Eleven, McDonald's, and Walmart, right? That's it. And on this, we're going to sustain the greatest democracy in the world. On this, we're going to sustain a military empire that nobody can challenge. On this, we're going to sustain an educated populace, a school system that is functional. On this, we're going to sustain hospitals that actually take care of people rather than just generate bills. Oh, my friends, our country is being sold out. We are being sold out. This is economic treason that has been foisted upon us by Ronald Reagan, George Bush Sr., to some extent Bill Clinton, and now full tilt boogie by George W. Bush. As Robert Scheer points out, here's the agenda as laid out by the president and the Republicans who control Congress. First, limit people's power to right wrongs done to them by corporations. Next, force people to pay usurious loans to credit card companies that make gazillions off the fine print. And third, for the coup de grace, hand over history's most successful public safety net to Wall Street. Now, as Robert Scheer points out, they don't actually call it that. What they call it is, this is the corporate lobbyist trifecta he refers to it as tort reform, eliminating abusive bankruptcy, and keeping Social Security solvent. Yeah, right. Mind-boggling. 1-866-889-8894 is our telephone number. Dave in Humboldt County has been patiently waiting on the phone for some time here, Dave. Hey, thank you so much for hanging out. What's up? Oh, I'm sorry. I've got the wrong line. Here we go. Dave, there you go.
Speak, am I on now?
Speak now. You are on now, yes.
Okay, well, I find myself with increasing frequency being asked, how did you know that, Dave? I didn't hear that on the news. I didn't read that in the paper, and I find myself more often than not explaining, well, I learned about that on the Tom Hartman show.
thank you.
So thank you for being there. You know, so much comes by that just, you know, you can't give it adequate attention before some other scandal hits. And I'm recalling one that came up just a few weeks ago in which I heard, and I believe it was on your program, that in order to go out and sell the people on how messed up Social Security was and the need to privatize it, he reached in the Treasury and grabbed $300 million to go out and disinform us on that. Do you recall that?
Yeah, I don't recall the exact amount, but yes, Social Security, the Social Security system, the Social Security Department, is using our Social Security money, which is supposed to be given back to us when we retire, or, you know, the 30% of it roughly that takes care of people who have children who've lost their families and you know, whatnot, survivor benefits and severely disabled. It is taking that money and right now using that money to mail out notices to particularly young people. I haven't gotten any of these notices, but I'm hearing from people in their 20s that they're getting these notices from the Social Security Administration telling them that there's a crisis in Social Security that needs to be solved by strong leadership, you know, blah, 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 blah. And they're doing advertising. Yes, absolutely. I don't know the dollar figure. I don't recall the dollar figure, but they are spending our money about it. And there are people in Congress who are raising their voices, including Republicans, saying this is wrong.
It is terrible. It's just taking our taxpayer money to misinform us on something that will do us great harm.
They did the same thing with Medicare, Dave.
Yeah.
They did the same thing with Medicare, and they did the same thing with No Child Left Behind and with the Education Department. This is using government to destroy government, essentially. And, gee, okay, it sounds great. I don't like the Department of Motor Vehicles. I don't like standing in line. You know, everybody has, I think it's, you know, part of the American DNA. They have a little bit of anti-government in you, you know. It's a, we don't like bureaucrats. We don't like being told what to do. There's a little bit of that in all of us that they play off of. But what people forget in all of this conservative rhetoric about shrinking government and doing away with terrible is that the government is us. It's us. This is how we decide how we want to live and what kind of country we want to live in and what kind of life we want to have and what standard of living we want to have. And we actually can determine those things by governmental policy, by our trade policies and by our domestic policies, by things like our having a Social Security program or not having a privatized. And it's just
I was also very happy that you allowed our young Humboldt Alice to tell about the upcoming peace demonstration. I hope we make that a big one this year.
Yes, I hope you do too, Dave, and spread the good word. Thanks for calling. It's great
Thank
to hear
you,
from
sir.
You. Yeah, it's always good to have you there. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Peter in New York is on the line. Hey, Peter, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Good afternoon. How are you doing?
Great. What's up?
Question for you. No, I'm quite perplexed with the Social Security debate going on, that no one ever mentions the effect it would have on the stock market.
Or the bond market.
I assume it would be quite dramatic. Am I mistaken in that?
Well, and the bond market as well. There's a lot of speculation about what the impact of this will be, and there are some who are speculating that there will be this incredibly positive impact if all of a sudden a lot of money gets diverted into the stock market. If you buy a stock right now, say you go out and buy 100 shares of IBM, you know, from your local stockbroker, you're not actually giving money to IBM. You're not actually investing in IBM. What you are doing is you are buying a piece of paper which represents an investment in IBM from somebody else who already owns it. In other words, it's moving around.
Similar to money.
Yeah. Well, it's sort of like playing Monopoly.
Right.
So you're not really, you know, the only time you can actually invest in a company is when they do an initial stock offering, an IPO. And, you know, when a company actually goes out into the marketplace and says, okay, we're going to sell stocks fresh and allow people to invest in us. And after that, it's everybody's just kind of recirculating the stock.
Right.
And so the outcome of this is that the value of stock, what the stock trades for, isn't so much a function of the value of the company as it is the demand for the stock. And so if suddenly you have a whole lot more people wanting to buy stocks, then the price of those stocks is going to start going up, even if the companies aren't worth more. And so, you know, there would be this short-term bubble where as everybody gets into the stock market starts going up really, really quickly. And then there would be this kind of reckoning point where people would say, hey, wait a minute, these companies aren't worth all this money. They're not showing these kinds of profits. They're not paying these kind of dividends. And then the savvy investors bail out, and all the rest of us are stuck holding, you know, a bubble that burst. It's exactly what happened in 2000, by the way. And so there's a lot of people warning about that. Peter, thanks for the call and raising the issue. And then, of course, it could also wipe out the bond market. There's a big concern there. 20 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
Got to go back. We got to go back. Got to go back. Got to go back. For the healing.
Now let's go back to rational economic policies.
With the dreamer.
Back to the American dream. We had a time in this country, the first 100 years of this country. Then we had this more or less 20-30 year experiment with conservative economics starting in the 1890s that wrapped up in the late 1920s when it all crashed, as could be reasonably predicted. And then you know, we got back on track again and said, okay, you know, the purpose of government is to define, one of the purposes of government is to define the rules of the game of business. We're going to say, hey, you want to do business here in the United States? Great. We would love that. We would love you to get rich. We would love you to be successful. We think it would be a marvelous thing. And by the way, Number one, you have to make sure that you're not harming we the people while you're doing it. And number two, there are certain rules you have to play by. There's certain minimums you have to pay people. There are certain taxes you have to pay for your use of the commons. There are certain ways that you have to behave. You have to make your books available. You can't produce toxic emission. And now what we've seen in the name of deregulation here over the last 30 years, over and increasingly now, we're seeing these laws being flipped on their heads. The regulatory agencies being taken over by the regulated, the foxes guarding the hen houses, and the result is we now have more mercury in our water, more, rather than getting into the rant here, John in Shreveport, Louisiana is on the line. Hey, John, what's on your mind today?
Hey, just want to ask you a quick question. Do you think Jimmy Carter was right to reinstate registration for the draft?
Yeah, I believe in a draft. I believe that we should have universal service. I think that we should.
I
do too. I think that we should do it the way that most countries do, where you have the choice of either doing military service or, like, for example, volunteering to work in a hospital, that kind of thing. But that every young man and I think every young woman as well, but certainly our young men, they need a rite of passage. And I hope this doesn't sound too sexist, but whatever. I really think, if you look at every traditional culture, there's this rite of passage that maybe it has to do with testosterone or something. I don't know what. But anyhow, they need this rite of passage about that time, 17, 18 years old. Give them a year in service. It works well in for example, in Germany, where I lived for a year back in the 80s, and I saw this. And it also provides people with a sense of they've given something to their country. They feel like they've bought into it.
I think you're right on the money with that one, Tom.
Yeah, well, thank you. And I would add, by the way, Thomas Jefferson agrees. He made the point very explicitly that every person should be a member of the army, that we should never have what he called hireling paupers. And he said, no man, we should never. He said it would be a disaster. I forget the exact phrasing. Something to the effect of it would be a shame should this country ever reach the point where its youth was willing to hire itself out to be shot at for a shilling. And that's where we're at right now.
I think you're not too far off on that.
Yeah. Well, thank you, John, for the call. Good to hear from you. And this whole other topic, of course. But I actually wrote a chapterlet, a little piece about this in my book, What Would Jefferson Do? That I really think we should have a draft. And I'm one of those people who was very upset with the draft when I was a teenager because it was during the Vietnam War. But I'll tell you, if it hadn't been for the draft, we never would have gotten out of Vietnam because it was just, average people going into the military. And that was one of the things that created the pressure not to have an insane war. One of the things that universal service does, if it really is universal, you don't want to have these situations where, like George W. Bush, people with power and influence can get into, like, the champagne unit is what they called the Texas Air National Guard. None of those guys went to Vietnam. Everybody knew it. You wouldn't go to, they weren't even flying the kinds of jets that they used in Vietnam. So you don't have that kind of a system. You have a system where everybody's kids are going to go off to war if you're going to declare a war. And I'll tell you, Congress will think twice before they decide to declare a war. If Jenna and Barbara, George's daughters, were to join the Army or the Marine Corps tomorrow morning, I have a feeling that things would be a little different over in Iraq real quick. 29 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Hey! And we got a whole conversation going here about the draft now in the chat room. And interesting points being made. For example, one of the major internal threats to democracy is a standing army. This is the point Jefferson made when he proposed that there be no standing armies during time of peace in the United States, but that every able-bodied male between the age of 18 and 47 should be a member of a militia and should have a gun in their home, and when the church bells ring a certain way, they grab the gun, they step outside, and boom, the entire country is the army, or at least all the men in the country are the army. It's what they do in Switzerland. It's one of the reasons many suggest that Switzerland was not invaded by the Nazis. I mean, who wants to take on a country where the entire country is the army? So this was Jefferson's strong suggestion. And in fact, when he became president in 1800, there were over 300,000 men in the army, in the United States Army. And he whittled that down to just over 3,000 from 300,000. Those of you who are math whizzes can tell me what that percentage is. That seems like down to 1%, right? In any case, then he took some flack for that, by the way, because after he left office, the War of 1812 happened and we didn't have much of an army. But he did build up the Navy, which helped somewhat. He thought that we should have a strong Navy, that we should protect our borders. He didn't build up the Navy enough. But that's a whole other discussion. But anyhow, the point is that the internal threat to democracy very often comes from the military. You want an example of this? Just take a look at Musharraf in Pakistan. What Musharraf in Pakistan played out is the thing that has historically over and over been played out, and that is, you know, a military coup. You've got, you know, somebody in the military, Raja, take over. We're going to take over the country. What? Because there's an army. They're sitting around, you know, nothing better to do. This is why Jefferson pushed this through, and in fact, it became Jefferson's argument that there should be no standing army, but instead that every man should be part of the army. That became the Second Amendment. And the problem was that he could never get a consensus to ban the army. So they just basically left the door open so that you could have a militia, that every person could have a gun. But anyhow, it's interesting when you learn the history of these things. But so, number one, a threat to democracy, and that is the army taking over, a military coup. And some would suggest that the Pentagon has, to some extent, particularly since the Cold War, taken over the government of the United States. They've certainly taken over a large chunk of the resources of the government of the United States. And they've got everybody. I mean, you know, whoever's the head of the Department of Defense at any given administration seems to terrify senators and members of Congress more than J. Edgar Hoover did. You know, Jack Kennedy with his spy pictures of Jack and Marilyn. So that was one problem. Another is that the country is less likely to go to war. It's just very simple. If every family has a stake in the future of it. Another one, a good point that was made on the message board, is that in an all-volunteer army, during time of war, if you're not pulling a lot of casualties, but you do have a war, and so pay goes up and prestige goes up, then it draws more heavily from the very lowest classes of society economically, and it encourages an economic system that keeps a lot of people in poverty so that they will be fodder for the army, which is not something that I think most of us would consider desirable, to have a large body of the working poor just to feed an army. And yet again, that very much is the world that the conservatives are taking us into. Yesterday I mentioned wealth inequality. And I just want to set the record straight on this stuff. United for a Fair Economy, faireconomy.org, has a series of wealth charts. And let me just lay this stuff out. The distribution of U.S. wealth ownership. Now, this is as of 2001. I know that it has gotten more disparate, more, you know, the rich have gotten richer and the poor have gotten poorer since then. But in 2001, the bottom half of America, the bottom half of America owned 2.8% of all the wealth in the country. The next 40%, so now we're talking the bottom half plus the next 40%, so that's the total of the bottom 90%. The next 40% owns 27.4%. You throw that into the bottom 50%, which has 2.8%, and you've got about 30%. So basically the bottom 10% I'm sorry, the bottom 90% of America owned roughly 30% of the resources. Now, similarly, the top 1% of America owns 32.7% of the resources. The next 4% owns 25%. So together, the top 5%, that's well over half. That's what, 57%? And then you toss in the next 5%, so we're looking at the top 10% altogether. It's another 12.1%, so we're up to 67, 68%, you know, coming up on 70%, which balances out the 30%. Number one. Change in average household net worth. Now, this is interesting. If you go back to the beginning of the Reagan Revolution, and you just track it from 1983 to 1998, change in average household net worth. The bottom 40% of Americans have seen their net worth, the assets that they own, the value of their homes, the value of everything they own, from the Reagan Revolution to today, the bottom 40% of America has seen their the value of their assets decline by 76.3%. The top 1% has seen their wealth grow by 42.2%. Tell me what's wrong with that picture. And then you look at income. The drifting apart. Here we have, again, we go back to the beginning of Reagan, 1979, to today, to 2001, to 3 years ago. The increase in family income. Now, before we were talking about wealth, what people own. Now we're talking about income, how much people are paid. The top 5% during that period of time from Reagan to today have seen their income go up 81%. Now, this is actual, this is not because of inflation. We're talking about inflation-adjusted dollars. They've seen their income go up 81%. The top 20%, seen their income go up 53%. The bottom 20%, 3%. The second 20% above that, 11%. And I would suggest these numbers are pre-recession, that it's probably much worse right now. And if you look at the change in after-tax family income between 1979 and 2000, and this reflects the Reagan tax policies by and large that rewarded the most wealthy. If you look at after-tax income, the bottom 20%, 9% increase, the second 20%, 13% increase, the middle 20%, 15% increase, the fourth 20%, so now we're up to the bottom, you know, the 80%, 24%. The top 20% saw a 68% increase in their after-tax family income. But the top 1%, now keep in mind, the bottom 20%, 9% increase in after-tax family income from the year Reagan was elected to the year 2000. Top 1%, 201% increase after taxes. In the meantime, we see that now personal bankruptcy rates in Michigan rose to an all-time high last year as working class families struggled with unemployment, credit card debt, and medical bills. More than 63,700 Michigan residents sought protection from their creditors last year, up 2.3% from 2003, and up 38% from 2001. Bankruptcies up 38%. Early numbers, they add, from this year are even grimmer. Filings in January were up 8% over last year. Sabrina Kinney was one of about 100 people who jammed into a federal courtroom last week in Detroit. This is from the Detroit News. To file for bankruptcy. I'm trying to keep an apartment, she says. Feed myself, pay my bills. She's a 25-year-old nursing assistant from Detroit who amassed significant medical bills after a car accident. I don't have any health insurance, she says, and no one wants to give you any. No, indeed. Bankruptcy attorneys, writes the Detroit News, this article by Karen Dibbis, the Detroit News, Bankruptcy attorneys and trustees say much of the rise can be attributed to Michigan's economic woes, including the state's shrinking manufacturing base. What could have caused that? Might it be Reagan-Bush, Clinton-Bush international trade policies? Globalization? Cuts in overtime? Same cause. Had high unemployment? We seem to be looking at the same thing here. Most vulnerable are those families who rely on credit to pay bills and lack the income to build up a nest egg that can see them through an emergency. Walter A. Metzen, a Detroit attorney, this guy handles about 1,000 bankruptcy cases a year. There's about 220 working days in a year. Aren't there 220, 240? I don't remember the exact number. Let's say just round it off to 200. If he's handling 1,000 of these a year, that means five people a day. He's taking on five new cases every single day. This guy's busy. Detroit bankruptcy attorney. His one shop, in fact, it says his one-man shop is so busy that he recently added two staffers to help him. He says, we're always the first to get hit when we have a recession and the last to recover. The we he's referring to, the working poor. His clients. Court officials worry bankruptcies could increase locally and nationally if proposed bankruptcy reform becomes law. Say what? It's going to get worse? Well, yes, my friends. This month, two bills were proposed in Congress that make it more difficult for individuals to file Chapter 7 bankruptcy. Metzen, this bankruptcy attorney, he says, the credit card industry will have you believe people plan to go into bankruptcy, but for most, it's a last resort. They just want the phone calls to stop. Medical bills are another trigger, notes the Detroit News. A Harvard University study released this month found that medical debt caused half of all personal bankruptcies. The research found that even families with medical insurance often couldn't afford to pay out-of-pocket expenses. The typical person claiming bankruptcy? Morris says, it's the person who gets behind by $3,000 to $5,000. Their income levels typically are not that high, so those debts are insurmountable. By and large, he says, it's not the high rollers you see in court. In fact, he says, a lot of folks are not in as good a financial position as they were 25 years ago. So what is the Republican response to this? This crisis, this explosion of poverty and bankruptcies in the United States? Well, they have a plan. They have a plan. As Michael Schroeder notes in the Wall Street Journal, an article entitled Senate Panel Backs Bill to Overhaul Bankruptcy Process, the Senate Judiciary Committee approved bankruptcy legislation to make it harder for people to walk away from their debts. And with Congress's bolstered Republican majorities, it appears that the long-disputed measure finally may make it into law. Yeah, the cons have a solution to this problem. Make it harder for people to file bankruptcy. There's too many people filing bankruptcies. Make it harder for them. The bill, sponsored by Senator Charles Grassley, Republican of Iowa, is similar to others that have been considered and nearly approved several times during the past 7 years. House Judiciary Committee Chairman James Sensenbrenner, Jr., Republican of Wisconsin, has introduced a nearly identical bill that would be into the House of Representatives. The bill is aimed at limiting the ability of consumers to use Chapter 7 to wipe out credit card bills and other loans unsecured by a house or other assets. The overhaul has been pushed most aggressively by credit card companies and banks. See, they want to create a situation where you just can't get out from underneath. Sorry. Consumer advocates argue that it would remove a safety net for those who have lost their jobs or face mounting medical bills. Senator Charles Schumer, Democrat of New York, said that he plans to propose the same amendment that has doomed the bill in the past. This is called a poison pill. He says he's going to put a provision on this bill that would prohibit protesters from using bankruptcy to avoid paying court fines for blocking abortion clinics if the demonstrators knowingly violated the law. And this is a cute little trick, right? As the Boston Globe notes in an article by Rick Klein, Globe staff, in this situation, the real losers are going to be middle-income working families, and effectively it's going to be the financial interests that are going to use the courts as collection agencies, said Senator Edward M. Kennedy. It is unconscionable, said Kennedy, to punish people because they have the misfortune to be sick. More than 1,700 physicians sent a letter to Judiciary Committee members on Monday urging them to reject the bill. But Senator Grassley, the Republican, called it a myth, that catastrophic illnesses and overwhelming medical bills spur most bankruptcies. It's a myth, although Harvard has documented it. 10 minutes before the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
For united we stand, divided we fall. And if our back should ever be against the wall, we'll be together.
As welcome to the radio support group of, by, and for We the People. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Mike in California on the line. Hey, Mike, where in California are you?
Santa Barbara.
Oh, great. What's up?
Just a quick question, because what you're talking about, bankruptcy, is always very interesting. Frontline did an interesting show, I guess, called The Secret Life of Credit Cards.
Yeah.
And they addressed a little bit of what you're talking to as far as bankruptcy and the laws that they're trying to address.
I have heard several people mention that to me. I have not seen it.
It's very interesting. What I can't find on these shows, or I haven't heard, and I've been trying to find, is information on statistic level, like what income level is filing for bankruptcy, because they don't address that. And what you said is right. The credit cards is in their best interest to make it sound like people are just racking up debt and then turning around filing for bankruptcy.
Right.
And I've fallen victim to that, too, believing that, you know, all these people are just wrecking, you know, buying new boats, things like that, and then they're going in to file for bankruptcy. But what's really not...
That's fraud. Really not, there's already laws against that, Mike. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, you hear that on Hannity and Limbaugh and whatnot. You,
right.
That's against the law. You go to jail for that.
Right. Unless you live in Florida. But what is...
Well, in Florida, you'd have to... The only way to get around it is with your house.
There's the same thing in Texas, correct?
Yeah, there's five states, actually. Texas and Florida are two of them. I don't recall the other three. But there are five states where your house can be used to shelter... to shelter from bankruptcy. And these were laws that were actually passed to protect poor people.
Right.
And what's happening is the Ken Lays of the world, when they see bankruptcy looming as a way out of their problems... They buy 10, 20, 30, 50, $100 million houses, put all of their assets into the house, then declare bankruptcy, and you know, for the hundreds of millions of dollars that from the shareholders suing them or whatever, and then they get the house, and then they can sell the house and keep the money.
When you talk about income level brackets,
yeah.
what is the percentage of, I mean, these people that are close to poverty line having to file for bankruptcy, and I guess is a growing problem with medical costs causing
more
bankruptcy.
Than half, according to a study done by Harvard University, more than half of all personal bankruptcies in the United States are the result of the inability to pay medical costs, and more than half of those are people who have health insurance.
Right,
and they just get wiped out by that. You know, well, we'll pay the first 80%, and you get a $200,000 bill, and all of a sudden you got to pay $40,000. You can't, you know, do it on a $12,000-$20,000 a year income.
Yeah.
I don't have statistics for you, Mike, on where the population breakouts are. I'm sure that they're out there, and there's probably websites entirely devoted to this. Maybe somebody in our chat room can track it down for us, and we'll get that information to you.
Right.
But not in the next 30 seconds, I doubt it. But I'm sure it's out there. But my experience is that the vast majority of bankruptcies that occur are occurring among the working poor.
Right.
They're among people who are making certainly less than $30,000 or $40,000 a year, and many of them less than $20,000 a year. And they just get, well, as this guy in Detroit News said, the average there in that area was $3,000 to $5,000.
Yeah.
And that's such a deep hole that they don't see any way they can ever get out of it.
It's horrible. You feel very bad. I feel very bad for these people.
These are real tragedies, but the Republicans are, you know, hey, screw them. You know,
they're killing us.
Yeah, well, we're going to put them on the back of a flatbed truck and drop them off at the corner every month or every morning and let them, you know, sit there with their begging bowl. That'll solve the problem. Mike, thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. I appreciate it. Oh, my. So much we can do. Your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity right here. I'm Tom Hartman. Thanks for being with us today.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.